Support for KPLU and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, with a reminder that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Gosh, I don't want to suffocate all of you, but could we close the door?
Yeah, no, I'm totally fine with that.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm Gracia Bridges, and I am 20 years old.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Stobie. I'm 19 years old.
And my name's Jordan Stobie, same last name. I'm 21.
We're currently in the back of our van, Maple.
Gracia, Jordan, and Rebecca, they're the founding members of the folk indie rock band Charlie and the Rays, and they've put college on hold for now. Their jobs at restaurants pay the bills, and the time and energy that's left, it all goes to the band. And we're inside Maple, the van, because it's the quietest spot we could talk. We're behind the Tractor Tavern in Ballard, because this is the night they're launching their first EP. It's called Black Licorice. Hi, I'm Jennifer Wing, by the way, and you're tuned to Sound Effect. Today we're talking about big dreams. And for these three young women, their dream of playing music together started when they were in high school.
Grish and I were kind of trying to find something to do and decided to start busking at Pike Place. And then from there, it grew. I remember Grisha actually got like a how to start a band book, and we were like reading it, trying to figure out how to start a band. And so we decided to get a drummer and just went from there.
And is there a larger dream than quitting your jobs?
Yeah.
And
there's a larger dream.
What is your ultimate dream?
Well, just like, I would love to go on tour, like a world tour. That would be like, I think if we go on world tour, that would be like, we made it, guys, like we did it.
Basically being a rock star and just being able to express myself through music, and that being my passion my whole life, and people following us as a band and liking what we create.
I would love to just be in a place where I show up to a gig and my guitar is already set up for me. That is my dream.
Well, should we hear some music?
I've been wishing every day that you'll say you're mine. Hoping every day that you'll find we're fine. So come over, little darling, say you're mine. So come over, little darling, say we're fine. I've been wishing every day that you'll say you're mine. Hoping every day that you'll find we're fine. So come over, little darling, say you're mine. Come over, little darling, and say we're fine.
There we go.
That was awesome. Now we have the story of a big dream from a small town. Soap Lake in central Washington is home to about 1,600 people, and its economy, it's seen better days. Now, a lot of small towns in that situation might respond by trying to lure a big box store or coming up with a snappy tourist slogan, but those ambitions, they're far too puny for Soap Lake. Instead, since the early 2000s, the town has been working toward creating something big and weird and really kind of beautiful. They want to build the world's largest lava lamp. So Sound Effect's Gabriel Spitzer got curious about this dream and met up with five enthusiastic city elders: Mayor Raymond Gravel, Don Long, Burr Beckwith, Andy Kovac, and his wife Nell Kovac, on a scraggly bluff above Soap Lake.
So they kind of gestured toward this empty space there amongst the brush and invited me to picture this 65-foot-high lava lamp that would kind of tower up above the lake and would be the highest structure in the town for miles, except for the water towers. And this is an idea that they have been working on for a really long time.
Basically, it's an idea that won't die. There's a certain magic about this lamp. And so the lamp could be like the Space Needle is for Seattle.
They really do kind of see this as their meal ticket. You know, things have not been great in places like Soap Lake. So Andy Kovac, the architect, imagines this as like plunking down a little Eiffel Tower, a little Statue of Liberty, right there in the middle of central Washington.
You know, these small towns are having a tough time everywhere. I've seen so many businesses come and go. People struggle. It's sad. If this happens, then we have a chance, a big chance.
When it happens.
Yeah. So as you can hear, these guys are thinking big. And you can really get the sense of that when you talk to Raymond Gravel. He's the mayor of Soap Lake. He's lived there for 10 years. And he actually moved to Soap Lake because of the lava lamp. Like, he and his wife were living in North Bend, and they were kind of looking to make a change. And then they sort of heard about this place, Soap Lake.
There was a motorcycle rally in Soap Lake. Oh, that's kind of interesting. What's Soap Lake? And then, of course, as soon as you Google that, you see the giant lava lamp. Oh, that's intriguing. And then the next thing you see is this mineral water. We just had to come over and say, hey, let's find out. And then we kept coming. And that's when we decided we were just going to sell everything, quit our corporate jobs, and start over in Soap Lake.
So the Gravels arrived, and then they met a guy named Brent Blake. And he is an important character in this story. He is the guy who came up with the whole idea for the lava lamp. He cooked this thing up. And Blake was an artsy type. He was a visionary. He was kind of a larger-than-life character, which raises the question, you know, was this whole idea cooked up in some kind of a drug haze? Well, they assure me that the answer is no, although the Drug Association has definitely kept a few scattered people in town from fully embracing the lava lamp idea. But no, they say this was all about art and creativity and really Brent Blake's free spirit, which Mayor Gravel says was very infectious.
Pretend I have a ponytail. It just went off a couple of months ago.
Oh, wait, you had a ponytail?
I had a ponytail, and I'd always had a clean corporate haircut until I moved to Soap Lake. I met Brent, was fascinated, recognized why he was called the Renaissance man, the visionary, and he had a ponytail. And I thought, well, if he can have a ponytail, I'm going to try one.
So Soap Lake is the place to go to get loose, it turns out. And a lot of it was because of this guy, Brent Blake, this charismatic, visionary person. So Blake, unfortunately, got leukemia, and he died in 2013. But his dream definitely did not die with him.
One of the things that I promised was to do my very best with whatever abilities and powers as mayor that I had to get the lava lamp built.
Did you really make him a promise toward the end of his life?
Yes. Yes.
That's some serious stuff.
It is. And I'm the kind of person that keeps my promises, and this group knows that. We all have the same promise.
The thing is, the original plan for the lava lamp was to make an actual 65-foot lava lamp. And if you've ever seen those things, you know they're full of water, and they have a heating element in the bottom, and it heats up wax, and the wax goes bloop, 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 and it kind of globbles up and down and makes this mesmerizing thing. But imagine a 65-foot high version of that. Think about how much water you would need. Think about how much wax you would need, like tons and tons of it, and how much energy you would need to heat it up. And so they started to kind of figure out what it would take to actually build one of these things. And here's Andy Kovac describing how Brent Blake sort of wrestled with that.
In the end, it simply wasn't, from a physics standpoint, it couldn't happen.
But why let a little thing like laws of physics stop you?
Not Brent.
So onward they went, and instead of abandoning this idea, they just dug in their heels, you know, they did not give up. And then some help arrived from an unlikely place. Basically, they got an offer for a free, pre-made 32-ton, 50-foot-high lava lamp from Target, like the store Target. And what happened was that Target actually had one of these things that they had built in order to hang on a building in Times Square in New York as like a big advertising stunt thing. And they heard about Soap Lake's oddball dreams, and they decided to donate this 50-foot-high mechanical lava lamp.
They took it down, they disassembled it, they trucked it all the way at no cost, and it landed here. And it was a roadside attraction. I mean, it was pretty gaudy.
Pretty gaudy. In fact, the people discovered once it got there, after they'd trucked it all the way across the country in pieces, that they kind of didn't like it very much. It was not a real lava lamp, as we discussed. It was a mechanical thing that had these fiberglass globule thingies that sort of gave the vague impression of looking like the lava lamp. And then on top of that, it turned out it had to actually be mounted on the side of a building. It was built that way, and they didn't have a big building to stick it on. So they kind of scrapped the Target lava lamp idea. In fact, it's still sitting in some kind of sad warehouse in Soap Lake as we speak, gathering dust. But they came up with a new idea, and this came from the brain of Andy Kovac, this architect. And I'm going to try to describe it so you can imagine what it looks like. Imagine a big steel pole, 60 feet high or whatever, that has these cables, these guy wires coming off of it, kind of maypole style. And then you wrap that cone in a special metallic fabric.
Kind of like a teepee. And then we had two laser light projectors on the inside located up above that would project in the round 360 degrees anything we wanted to project on a computer. You know, the technology really is there. It's starting to catch up to the point that I'm afraid somebody else is going to do it before us.
The idea was that these projectors would project the gloopy globules of the lava lamp thing onto the sides and give the illusion of the lava lamp motion. And I've seen the renderings, the artist's renderings, and it does look really pretty cool. And Mayor Gravel assured me that even though it's a lava lamp, it's going to be classy.
The thing about this, it will be a piece of art. It won't be this big, clunky, garish metal thing out there. It'll be beautiful.
Yeah. How do you see it as being different from a novelty or a roadside attraction kind of thing?
Well, I mean, there's that element. You can't deny that. But like a pit full of rattlesnakes and stuff like is one thing. But if you have something like that, it is a work of art. It's a plus.
You could have a ready-made laser light show on this lava lamp thing. And in fact, there's a pretty famous laser light show that happens just up the river at Grand Coulee Dam, and they sort of thought that this could complement it. And then there were other things you could do, too. You could put ads on it, potentially. You could invite people to have their company picnic out there and put the corporate logo on the lava lamp. I mean, they are actually thinking practically about it in a way that makes you think maybe this is an actual doable civic project. So talking that way, it's hard not to get carried away by this whole sense of enthusiasm and this can-do spirit of this small town. But I learned as things went on that there is one small hitch, and here's how Andy Kovac explained it.
The company that owns the rights, we were working with their CEO, and he was all over this project. He was going to be here at the opening. He left. The new guy came in and said, I want nothing to do with this. And this is after we put so much effort into this project. It was pretty incredible. We really want them to work with us, and we're going to continue to pursue that. And so we're taking our time and trying to do that as positively and correctly as possible.
So, yeah, they don't really have the buy-in anymore from the company that makes lava lamps. And because of that, they haven't actually been able to raise money to do it. And so it's kind of stalled the whole thing out. And I did call the company Lifespan Products, which now holds the trademarks to lava lamps. And they promised to call me back with a statement and did not. There is a page on their website that talks all about their trademarks because this has come up over and over again online because people Photoshop lava lamps into stuff and all kinds of stuff. And so they have this whole thing that says, hey, we're free spirits too, but trademarks are serious business. And if you don't safeguard your trademark, you can lose it. So hard to see where that's going to go. But, you know, I got to say, if the laws of physics can't stop this project, then maybe a little legal hangup won't be such a big deal either. Here's Mayor Gravel again.
When the lava lamp's built, it'll be the beginning of a new renaissance for Soap Lake. I've told people all along, we'll have to have special traffic control. There will be traffic jams all the way down to the highway. People are going to be as mesmerized by the giant lava lamp as they are by the one sitting in their living room.
That story from Sound Effects' Gabriel Spitzer. Still ahead on the show, we'll hear from a woman who is living her dream on another planet, and we'll tell you a story about how coming across an old sweater was, for one couple, like finding the golden ticket. That and more on Sound Effect. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're telling stories of people who dream big. And for Melissa Rice, the dream is science. It began to take root in an astronomy class.
We started talking about the life and death of the sun. And it hadn't occurred to me before that the sun had a life cycle, that our star was middle-aged and it would die someday. And that afterwards, there would be no more solar system. And in the sun's death throes, it would expand to the huge red giant stage, burn up the Earth and everything that had ever existed. And that's when I thought, wow, this is a pretty big deal. So I decided at that point that science was really the only thing worth studying, because in 4.5 billion years, after this happens and the solar system is kaput, science is going to be the only thing left.
Melissa Rice is now a professor of planetary science at Western Washington University. Sound effect producer Ali Ferguson talked to her about how that moment in a high school science class led her to searching for signs of life on Mars.
Mars stood out to me as a place outside of the Earth, out there in the universe, that was still tangible in some sense. I guess tangible literally in that we can send our robot explorers, our robot avatars to Mars and literally touch the surface, but also tangible in the sense that I could relate what I'm studying on Mars to my human experience here on Earth.
And so eventually you find yourself on the Mars rover team. What is the goal of the Mars rover program?
Yeah, the goal is to understand the potential of our solar system to harbor life outside of the Earth. Another big goal is to understand the evolution of other bodies in the solar system. So how does a planet like Mars, that starts from the same fundamental building blocks as the Earth, evolve into such a different world than the Earth is today? And eventually, the big goal is understanding whether Mars did have life. It all gets back to, are we alone? Is there anything out there beyond ourselves?
And this is a pretty ambitious goal, especially with the Mars 2020. You want to get a robotic vehicle to Mars to collect things and then bring it back to Earth. Am I right?
That's right. Every rover that we have sent to Mars so far, every spacecraft that we've sent, has gone there to die on Mars. This next rover, going in the year 2020, is going to be the first rover that is making steps towards what we call MSR, Mars Sample Return. And this rover itself is not going to return to Earth, and it's not even going to send samples from Mars back to Earth. It's going to be the first in what will probably take 3 stages of missions to get rocks from the surface of Mars back to Earth. So this rover is going to have what's called a sample caching system. It's essentially a bunch of fancy tubes that the rover will drill rock cores, stick those cores into the tubes, hermetically seal them, and leave them on the surface for hopefully the next stage, maybe 10 years down the road, to go to Mars, pick up those sample tubes, and launch them away from Mars. After that, it will probably take a 3rd mission to collect those sample tubes that are now floating in space, orbiting around Mars, to rendezvous with those, grab those samples, and bring them back to Earth. If things go well, we will have those samples here on Earth in hand by the mid-2030s. We're in this for the long haul.
So one of the first big challenges is deciding where to send the next Mars rover. And that's something you're very much involved in. Why is this so difficult?
Yeah, so this is a question that I pose to my planetary geology students. Imagine you're an alien and you have been looking at the Earth through telescopes, and you have pictures of most of the planet, but you've only been down to the surface a couple of times. And now it's your first chance to land on the surface of Earth and actually pick up something that you can bring back. But you can only land in one spot on the Earth, and it has to be within 30 degrees of the equator, just from the landing trajectories and where it's safe to go and temperature considerations. And you can't go on the top of a mountain because there's not enough atmosphere to slow you down for a safe landing. And you can't go to the bottom of a deep canyon because it's too windy. So you have all these constraints. And you can only land on one spot on the planet. And you can only drive around for about 10 kilometers and pick up about 20 pieces of the surface. Where on the Earth would you go? So there are different types of places we can go to on Mars. We can go to places that are like places on the Earth that are known for being good places to preserve evidence for past life. Places like lake beds. Several of the sites are also hydrothermal sites. One of the leading theories for the kinds of environments where life may have evolved on the early Earth are deep sea hydrothermal vents. So I'm torn.
Really?
Because there are so many interesting places, and you know, I take solace in knowing that we know so little about Mars, that any place we go, you could throw a dart at a map of Mars, and we would learn an exponential amount about the planet. But a site that I am advocating for is a site called Eberswalde Crater, which is one of these ancient lake beds on Mars. And this is a special crater because it has what is the best preserved river delta. And river deltas are special because they're places where flowing water has met standing water and sediment has built up. And we can tell by how much sediment has built up and the way that the channels migrate in that river system, we can get an idea for how long that lake would have had to have been there. And maybe it was long enough for life to have taken hold.
There's a lot of uncertainty in this work, as well as technical difficulties, and then there's just slow-moving bureaucracy, not to mention just the time it takes to get to Mars. All of that working against you, what keeps you going?
The thing that keeps me going are these moments that come throughout my work, that a return to that sense that I had when I was an angsty 16-year-old trying to figure out what to do with my life and realizing that science was something bigger than myself. I get glimpses of that in my work. Some days when I'm working on the operations of the Curiosity rover, I will be one of the first people, if not the first person ever, to see one of the pictures that has come down from the night before on Mars, and to be the first person in the world to see a new vista of an alien world. That is a moment that can keep me going through bureaucratic slog and months of waiting for our spacecraft to arrive at Mars.
Well, Melissa Rice, professor of planetary science at Western Washington University, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you're just joining us, you're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today on the show, we're telling stories about big dreams. Sean and Ricky McAvoy, they're professional pickers, a husband and wife team. They scour thrift shops all over the country, digging around in bins, looking for vintage clothing to resell. And a couple of years ago in North Carolina, they found an old, moth-bitten West Point college sweater. They paid 58 cents for it. But a chance discovery revealed it was worth so much more. Podcast producers Warren Langford and Alex Cartwright visited the couple at their home in Tacoma.
It's okay. You don't mind, I just started recording.
Oh, no, not at all. It's like a week out of every month I'll travel and go to as many states as I can trying to find stuff to meet with other dealers.
I do pretty much everything, behind the scenes. Sean finds the stuff, and once a piece of clothing comes home, there's a lot to do to get it cleaned, if it needs to be mended, steamed, photoed, listed, hung up, organized, shipped.
I started probably when I was like 18 or 19 years old. I was working for like Red Light, and it just was so... Red Light's a vintage store in Seattle, Washington. And so I ended up, not working there anymore, and then started like picking full time. Then I've been doing that for like almost 16 or 17 years now. I just always kind of liked cool stuff, and I liked finding it for next to nothing.
I think a lot of people get the idea that it's just, you just show up to the Goodwill and you find like a $500 pair of jeans. You'd notice like the cycle, of like kind of like the new folks that show up for a while and then you're gonna deal with that. Sean is really good though, because he's better at dealing with that than Vince. He just has a way of really trying to vibe people out.
Intimidate them?
Yeah, or just like make them think that Sean's just like crazy, so they kind of just leave him alone. So he has the advantage of just being really one of the only ones around, like a certain area of clothing or like a new rotation.
We were just kind of like killing time, And it was like at the end of the day, and we're like, oh, we should just stop by the bin, see if anything's there.
There was just this one bin with some old stuff in it. And it was like, you could tell it all came from the same guy because it was all kind of the same size and era. And there was like, there was a sweater and there was a vest. Had like some moth issues, but if you see anything like that, you don't really throw it back. You still take it, even though like, have, you know, you can't really like sell it for much because, you know, it's moth ridden, but still it's just, you can't really imagine it going through a shredding machine.
Did anybody see this? It's like, and they're like, yeah, it's got like a hole in it. It's like stained. It like don't really look right, you know? Like, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but it is what it is, you know? So I was like, okay, I guess I'll buy it. And then I like bought it. You know, we end up getting so much stuff. As you can see, it's like all bagged up in the basement like that, that like things get kind of put on the back burner and you kind of lose track of them.
I put it all in a repair pile. It's more than a pile. It's more of just like, I've got just, it's like a room. I came across a West Point sweater. I mean, the wool and everything was strong. The hardware was great. There was just a few moth holes. So I had it sitting on my lap, and I was just kind of like looking at it and figuring out like what thread and stuff like that to use. And I had this feeling that I was like, I just need to not touch this. And like, I need to not change it or even alter it or do anything. So, and it was kind of weird because I never had that feeling about anything before. It was the next day. Sean was in the bedroom and he was tired, so he was going to take a nap, but he was watching
a Vince Lombardi like documentary on like HBO or something like that.
Exclusion of everything else, Lombardi was focused on football and his relentless pursuit of a head coaching job. He hoped West Point would be the catalyst for such a move.
I was like, oh, cool. I was like, I didn't know he like coached at West Point, or like I kind of did, but it was like in the back of my head somewhere.
It was right at the same time that I walked into the bedroom to go drop something off. There was that photo that they were showing, the documentary of him standing there with his West Point sweater on. And I look out of the corner of my eye and I'm like, wow, like that's the same sweater that we have.
And I was like, oh, sweet. That wouldn't that be funny if like that was actually Vince Lombardi's?
And like this light went off because I remembered when I was looking at the sweater the day before and I was looking over it, I turned over the waistband and there was a piece of fabric and it had handwritten.
And I was like, well, what does it say, Lombardi or something? Like kiddingly. And she's like, yeah, that's what it says.
I'm like, no, Sean, I'm not you. That's the sweater we have. Like, that's the sweater. It's like, it has his name on the inside.
Found something that's worth the money. I didn't know if it was going to be worth $1,000 or $200,000. And
Sean's just a huge sports fan, but I think like Sean like lives and breathes for football. It was like the holy grail to him. Like he was just like, at that point he just felt like lucky being able to like touch it, you know. So
it felt like there was this weird like aura around it that it felt special from the time that we found it. And it just kind of like, it's like, well, that's pretty neat. But I've found stuff that was valuable before, but not like that.
I mean, we went out of town like the day out, a couple days after. I had my phone off for like a couple days. And then on the way back, I turned my phone on. I have like all these emails and all these voicemails from different news channels and stuff that like want to interview us and stuff. I'm like, really?
New tonight, a man shopping at a Goodwill store in West Asheville ended
up with the find of his life.
I was watching a Vince Lombardi documentary. I was like, oh, we have a sweater that's just like that. Like, wouldn't that be crazy if it was actually Vince Lombardi?
Turns out it did belong to the legendary football.
It's just kind of stressful because you really have no idea if it's going to sell for $5,000 or, you know, $100,000. So you were just kind of like, I mean, we knew we were going to do well on it, but $43,000 was pretty nice, you know?
Pretty cool how it all like came together too, because you think about it and you're like, I would have never have known this unless Sean was really tired that day and needed to go and take a nap and watch ESPN at the same time. People were smug as to us, too. because it's not what's on the news. And they, you know, just this industry is just like real competitive. Everybody tries to act like they own it.
I'll tell you one thing that's really funny. Like with other pickers that like do what I do for a living, there's like all, you know, there's like a kind of like a weird under hierarchy system that kind of goes in it. Like I don't even talk about that sweater at all. Like it doesn't come up in conversation. Be like, oh, who do you think you are? You're like Vince Lombardi sweater. And I'm like, I don't know, like, why are you mad? Like, I get that, like, all the time, and I'm just like, okay.
The cost of moving cross-country, I mean, a lot of that sweater paid for the move, too.
Like, money to me never, like, would make a difference. You know, it makes things a little easier. If I won Mega Millions, I would still be doing the same thing. I would still be digging in dumpsters, because I just like to, I like the thrill of the hunt. I like treasure hunting. It sucks when it's bad and you're not finding anything, but when you do find something, you're like, yes!
That story comes to us from Warren Langford and Alex Cartwright and was originally produced for their podcast, Personal Effects, which can be found at personaleffectspodcast.com. Coming up, a man who has spent decades building a one-of-a-kind collection now wants to share it with the world. It's all about big dreams today on Sound Effect. Welcome back. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Wing. This week, we're telling stories of people who have really big dreams and are working to make them come to life. In 1968, Richard Berger was in his 20s and in medical school in Philadelphia. It was his lifelong calling to help people, to be a doctor. But even though he was an honor student, medical school just wasn't what he thought it would be.
And what I found was a lot of authoritarian and rote memorization. And I went, this is so not what I envisioned. And it was kind of stunning because it's like, here I am with this dream of like what my life is going to be about. And it's like crashing into a concrete wall at 100 miles an hour.
Richard took a year off and went on a road trip across the country.
By the time I hit Wyoming, I see this dilapidated plywood sign that's sort of peeling apart. And we're dripping letters out of like out of the Addams Family, and it says Rock Shop, and like I'm a kid from New Jersey, so for me it's like rocks are things you kick down the street when you're bored and you have nothing else to do. So I walked in there, and almost immediately I was struck by this tiny little piece. It was like maybe an inch high, sitting on a shelf, and it struck me as one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen, and I was absolutely stunned. And so while I thought that I was running away from my future by leaving medical school, I ran right into it.
Over the last 48 years, Richard Berger has crisscrossed the globe, hunting for rare and beautiful creations that come out of the ground, minerals, crystals, fossils. And the private collection he's pieced together is said to be one of the finest in the world, and he calls it masterpieces of the earth. These exotic formations, some that are so small they can fit in the palm of your hand and others that require a forklift, they're stored in a warehouse just outside of Seattle. Inside, it feels like a gallery.
The walls are black and the tables are black, and we have, you know, beautiful pin spots on all the pieces. And in this room, which is one of the smaller chambers of the collection, are some of the rarest pieces of their kind in the world.
This looks like an egg embedded in a piece of granite. It looks like some sort of speckled pheasant egg.
In natural light, it's robin's head egg blue, and it's erupting out of a bullseye agate. So the way it was found in 1961, a woman was mining for agates in Montana. She drops it on the asphalt on the way back to her car in the parking lot. It cracks open. Here's this perfect egg sitting in the middle of a rock. So she gets it that this is not normal, right, and contacts the National Museum. And they had reviewed it, I think, all of their paleo and mineral people. And what they said in this letter was, the one thing we can tell you is that it's never been a fossil. Nature has managed to find a way to create the archetypal form of eggs independent of biological life.
But,
right.
But there, it was never a fossilized
egg. It was never
egg.
A fossil.
Yeah.
It never had anything to do with biological life. So it's the only one that's ever been seen.
Right. How does that happen?
Isn't that the great question? Yeah, I mean, how does life happen? You know, there's some mathematical algorithm that's at work here that if you run it through a computer, you know, they will match to an egg. But if you look at any of these, they're incomprehensible. I mean, that's part of my criteria for acquiring them, that I would look at them, and if my hands didn't wind up on my temples, you know, going like, what? They probably weren't part of the collection.
Just around the corner in the next room is a 7,000-pound enormous yellow crystal. And Richard says it's one of the most ancient giant crystals on planet Earth.
So as a reference point to age, which gets rough to grok, right, that this crystal has been fully formed on Earth for 250 million years before the first dinosaur appeared. Right. And there was an astrophysicist that came in here who said, you know, it takes about 240 to 250 million years for the sun to travel entirely around the Milky Way. So to make one circumnavigation around the entire galaxy, that crystal has done this twice.
So where was this found?
This was found in Namibia, Southwest Africa, and they were mining basically for gemstones. That looks right out of something from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, if, you know, you go into the ancient temple and you open the secret door, and if you saw that, you'd be on your knees.
Now, this collection, it's worth millions of dollars. And Richard has recently had a few lucrative offers from buyers in China. But saying yes, that would interfere with his ultimate mission in life, which is to have someone buy the collection, but then keep it in Seattle, where Richard wants to build a museum so that everyone can see these things.
What we want to create is an immersion experience. So rather than going in and going, oh, that's nice, take a picture or two and you're gone, that you basically enter into it like you would if you went to a redwood forest, you know, or hung out by a waterfall, that it touches you, right? So you go into, let's say you walk into a room and there's like the 7,000-pound crystal, right? And there's a water element. Maybe it's floating, above like a pond, right? And there's tropical palm trees and waterfalls and places to sit and contemplate, you know, and hang out. And so there's all these different venues in which people can go and just really take their time. So like if one wants to get a real sense of like, so tell me what the Earth was like before we were even here. You know, you're looking at it. People protect what they love. And what I'm trying to do is create a love affair here.
That's Richard Berger, whose ultimate dream is building a public home for his collection of rare rocks, minerals, and fossils. He's 72 years old and says if his goal isn't realized by the time he dies, close friends promise to see things through. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we're telling stories of people who dream big. And this next story is about people who take that very literally. They dream of big trees, the tallest and biggest trees they can find. And Sound Effect producer Allie Ferguson is here to explain why. Hello, Allie.
Hey, Jennifer. Yeah, so these folks, they're mostly trained arborists, and they keep track of the tallest trees of each species in a national registry. And they go out into the forest to collect data on height and circumference and canopy length. And this involves special lasers and actually climbing the trees to figure out how tall they are.
Why do they do this?
Well, that's what I wanted to find out. But first, I wanted to see one of these really tall trees in person.
You are connected. You are on belay.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I think so. I think I'm ready.
Okay.
That's arborist Mick Miazio. He's clipping me into a harness, and he's about to send me up into the tallest tree in Tacoma's Point Defiance Park. And I'm terrified. But I put my feet on the thick trunk of the tree, grab the orange rope, and begin to pull myself up.
Huh. It's a really big tree. It's only mildly terrifying. Oh my god, they look so small.
At about 50 feet up in the air, I can see why Mick became an arborist. It's surreal to be up in the branches, like a squirrel or a bird. And that's exactly how Mick has always felt.
I remember climbing my first tree when I was a kid. I come from inner city, a lot of concrete, some trees. And there was this tree that's really not too big, but for a kid, it's a whole universe, right? As soon as I was able to, I jump right in there and I disappear, you know? I'm in my own world right there.
Mick loves trees. But this Jersey boy with Polish roots, he's more than just a worshiper of the forest. He's a missionary, a tree zealot. He wants everyone to love trees. And he's so intense, so earnest about it, sometimes it seems like he might actually convert the whole world. I am, of course, Mick's next convert, which is how we ended up in Point Defiance Park on a sunny Friday morning, hugging the trunk of a giant Douglas fir. Mick was the first to discover the park's tallest tree. He noticed it poking out of the canopy when he moved to Tacoma 3 years ago.
One day I went on Google Earth and took a virtual flight, and I flew up to the what I thought was the tallest tree, took GPS coordinates, then I took some measurements, and eventually confirmed that the tree is 217 feet tall.
And what did you do when you first found this tree you'd been searching for on the internet?
When I first found this tree, when I heard the bass, I fell to my knees. I just fell to my knees.
Why is that?
I was overwhelmed. I looked at it and it was beautiful. You know, I found myself in the presence of this live being that is probably as old or older than this nation. That's just powerful.
And what was it like when you climbed to the top?
That was also very powerful. You know, I made a decision a few years ago to devote my life to trees, I guess. And so it was like all that effort, dedication, sacrifice coming together in this one moment and place.
Can you describe what it looked like?
If you're at the base of it, depending on the time of the day, it's sort of dark. Right, because you have all these surrounding trees and plants and stuff. But once you ascend further up, you start being above everything else around you, and you can see the Cascades, you can see the Narrows Bridge, you can see Tacoma, you can see Mount Rainier, Mount Baker, Vashon. Yeah, the views are beautiful.
But Mick isn't just a solo adventurer. He's part of a national group of volunteer arborists and citizen scientists collecting data on tall trees. It's called the Big Tree Program. And the guy who tracks Washington State's big tree data is Mick's boss and mentor, Zeb Handy. Zeb says the program got started back in the 40s.
When folks across the United States would argue about whose tree was biggest, and it kind of became a state versus state kind of thing. And it still goes on like that. There's still rivalry amongst the states. But each state kind of runs it on its own through American forests. So many of these trees are just in places that we'll never find them unless somebody tells us, hey, we think we have a big tree. I found one. Just in the course of work, some folks had me out to look at their apple trees and pull up this long driveway. And I can see through the carport a very large maple tree. And it turns out I think it's the third largest big leaf maple in the world. It's just in their backyard. They had no idea.
Why is it important to know where the big trees are?
Their living history. They've been in that spot for a long time before people lived there. And you can see it in the way that they grow, the way the branches are formed, broken, and regrow, and the hollows underneath that critters have lived in and that kids have played in.
Mick also loves that giant trees reflect the passing of time, and that these old-growth forests are home to endangered species like the marbled murrelet. And he likes contributing to the scientific effort to make up for his own small impact on nature. But his ambition is deeply personal, too.
One thing that's always in the back of my head is my brother. And he was murdered a few years back. And he was a great guy, even though he had a rough life. And one of the things he had was a great connection with nature, like birds would sit on his hands and things like that. And so after he passed away, first of all, I tried to be more like him, because that's the time, right? Well, second of all, I did get an idea in my head that I would like to discover a tree and dedicate it to him. And so those are some reasons that you may call selfish, but I would like to share this with people so that they can be proud, they can be aware, they can care, protect. You know, kids nowadays have problems with attention span, and adults too. You come here and you don't have to be focused and strained. You can just be. And I hope that when people just are, that they're good and full of love. And even if there's things that made people hard in their lives, that softens up and dissolves.
And that gets to Mick's next big dream, which is actually kind of small. He wants to share the wonder of the forest with everyone through their memories of trees.
What trees did they climb when they were a kid? What tree, you know, memories they have as adults? What tree memories they have with their families? I think that would be pretty neat.
Mick says everyone has a memory about trees, and he hopes that by sharing those memories, strangers will connect and remember their love of nature. I got to see some of these connections firsthand. One of the best things about Mick's favorite tree in Point Defiance Park is that it's a Pokestop. Yes, you heard me right, a stop in the hit game Pokemon Go. And so while Mick and I were hanging out in the dim green light of the forest, chatting about the importance of trees, folks kept strolling by, looking for Pokemon. And you'd think this ardent nature lover would be annoyed by people walking through the forest on their phones. But nope, it's just another opportunity to talk to strangers about trees.
Sue, can I ask you something?
Sure.
Did you climb trees when you were a kid?
Did I climb? Yeah.
What trees?
Oh, there was a willow in the backyard, a couple of maples, and...
I'm pretty close.
Hold on a second. Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Did you climb trees when you were a kid?
Of course, he climbs trees now.
That's awesome.
Have a great day.
After these little interactions, Mick sits back down smiling. He's thrilled his tree was at the center of these small human moments. But this tree has been witness to so many of Mick's dreams. He got married here, at the base of the tallest tree in Point Defiance Park. Mick says he's not a religious person, but he has faith. And being in nature, in the forest, it's like being in church. So Mick keeps searching for tall trees, chasing that sacred feeling, and hoping others will share his dream.
That story from sound effect producer Allie Ferguson. That's going to do it for this week's show. Sound effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad, Allie Ferguson, and with help this week from Gabriel Spitzer, Warren Langford, and Alex Cartwright. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find our podcast on iTunes, where you can take a minute to rate and review the show, and you can also find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. We'll be back next week, same time, same place, and we'll be talking about making amends.
I'm so glad that I stuck it out, because it would all be for nothing. You know, at least I'm reaping the reward, you know, and we're reaping the reward as a family. Our life today is the life that when I was, you know, 18 years old and in love with him and knew that he was the man I was going to marry, the life we have today is that life that I envisioned.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 FM.